Hello, this is Dale Connolly from The Morning Show with a collection of bits taken from our daily broadcast. This week, we'll deal with smoking shacks, financial issues related to your dog's happiness, and a big prize for a Minnesota musical icon and a reaction to it from another musical icon. It's Icons for Everyone on The Morning Show podcast, so please stay tuned. This is The Morning Show on Minnesota Public Radio in the Twin Cities, The Current, and now joining us live from the meeting that never ends, Dealmaker Spin Williams. Good morning, Spin.
Yes, good morning. We're discussing the new smoking shack idea that's coming out of Minnesota, and we just love it. Don't we love it, people? Yes, we do. This could be the new icon there, like the loon, you know, and Paul Bunyan and that wrestler guy.
Jesse Ventura, you mean?
Right, him. A Minnesota smoking shack. It's just perfect.
Well, what is it exactly that you like about it, Spin?
I see it as part of a larger marketing trend where everything is becoming more specific and personal and targeted. The customer chooses. Before, when you sat in a smoky bar, well, everyone would get poisoned slowly and in every possible way. Now, if the legislature approves smoking shacks, you'll be able to poison your liver in one room and then go to a different room to ruin your lungs. And if you want to ruin both your liver and your lungs at the same time, why not carry your drink into the smoking shack? I mean, that's customer service.
Right, but the one thing you can't do is, I guess you can't eat in the smoking shack, though.
Why not a third room, then, to get fat?
Okay.
Drinking shack, a smoking shack, and a gorging shack. I mean, Minnesota will be the most shackadelic place in the whole country.
But I think the idea originally was simply to give some shelter to people who would normally go outside to smoke in the cold or the snow or the rain.
That may be the idea, Dale, but I'm an idea man, and let me tell you, the idea you start with and what you get at the end can be two very, very different things.
So, Spin, if you were in the Minnesota Senate, would you look favorably on this?
Absolutely. This would be a huge growth area. I mean, huge, with very creative possibilities to build themed smoking shacks. I mean, what about a smoking shack that was designed like the inside of a cloud? You know, a cloud room with white walls and fluffy decorations, so when it fills with smoke, you feel like you're floating up towards heaven. How about that?
Well, it might hint too strongly towards the afterlife, which becomes an uncomfortable issue for heavy smokers.
There was another suggestion for a smoking shack that is decorated to look like the inside of a giant lung. And the more smoking that goes on in the shack, the blacker it gets.
You know, I don't think people would be comforted by that, though.
It's not about comfort, Dale. It's about defiance, rebellion. It's that I don't give a darn spirit. Or, hey, how about underwater room, like you're under the lake ice in January with this weird green light filtering in from a hole in the roof? The theme possibilities are just endless.
That's why they call you the idea man.
Absolutely.
But, you know, financially stressed bar owners don't have the money to do this elaborate construction you're talking about.
Okay, what about naming rights? Companies that make medical ventilators might be interested.
Medical ventilators, really?
Well, you've got to get your name in front of the customer before they need your product.
So this is all just a marketing opportunity for you, isn't
Everything
it?
Is marketing, Dale. That's why our meeting never ends.
Joining us from the meeting that, well, goes on and on and on, Dealmaker Spin Williams. This is the morning show on Minnesota Public Radio in the Twin Cities, The Current. Good morning and welcome. I'm Dale Connolly. This is Mr. Jim Ed Poole.
Good morning.
It's a Friday. It's the 4th of April, and this section of our show is brought to you by Bowser Bed, the vibrating pad for dogs, because your dog is worth the time and trouble it takes to make him happy, even though some members of the family may disagree.
My wife wanted to buy, like, a truckload of toys for Sparky, and those things are, like, what, the $10, $15 a piece. So I said, no. At one time, we gave him a little stuffed mailman. Well, he just tore it to shreds. I was picking up wads of fluffy stuff and tiny little envelopes for weeks.
In today's world, you have wonderful opportunities to lavish your dog with extravagant gifts, luxurious treatments, even expensive operations, but it's not always an easy decision.
Well, then she said she, or he, the dog, should get lip reduction surgery because his jaws are so droopy. That's the way she said, so droopy. I mean, his lips hang way down below his chin, you know, and I said in a very calm fashion, I said, so what? He's a dog! And then she said, well, if his face could be tightened up a bit, if we could color, you know, the white hair on his snout so he doesn't look so old, it would help his confidence level around the other dogs. So I said, you know, forget about the snout dying. Why not give him a full body wig? And that's the reaction I got. It didn't go over very well.
Budget struggles within families around the issue of dog financing are especially difficult as the economy slows, but it almost always comes down to one very simple thing.
Well, you know, the dog needs to be happy. There's no point in having a morose dog in the house, you know, dragging everybody down. The tail wagging part of what he does, it's really important to setting the mood around our house, and I was willing to invest in that, but the question was, how much?
Well, the good news is, you don't have to send your dog to a spa or a plastic surgeon, and it's not necessary to shower him with gifts to make him happy. Not if you put your resources into the one surefire mutt pleaser on the market today, the Bowser Bed Vibrating Pad for Dogs. Yes, with the Bowser Bed, Sparky will get all the enjoyment he might otherwise receive from destroying a dozen expensive toys, a whole fleet of mailmen, and he knows not to bite the Bowser Bed because it's electric. Yes, and because it provides an all-over massage that's never-ending, Sparky gains an alpha dog level of confidence that would cost thousands if you tried to accomplish the same thing with canine cosmetic surgery.
Well, his jowls look looser than ever, and he's jiggling massive fur and just slobber.
Yes, and he feels great. He feels young. He feels happy. And if he could stand up right now, which he can't, but if he could, you would see his tail is wagging. And when he finally does get off that Bowser bed, it'll be like, well, it'll be like a human, say, going on a long cruise and then getting off the boat, and the tail will still be wagging for days and weeks afterwards.
Maybe I'll spend a little time on that Bowser bed.
A good option if your spouse hasn't touched you in weeks because you've been arguing about the dog's bills.
Move over, Sparky.
Bowser Bed, the vibrating pad for dogs, a sound investment in the emotional infrastructure of your home at a reasonable price. Pick one up for your best friend today. You'll be glad you did. Everyone will. And what a surprise. Tony Bennett is here.
Yeah. I'm always here for you. You know that.
Yeah, well, usually you appear magically when your name is spoken, like some sort of genie, but I don't believe your name was spoken on the show yet today.
Well, maybe you were just thinking about me. I hope
I
never stop thinking about me and play my songs.
I was actually thinking about Bob Dylan winning a special Pulitzer Prize yesterday.
Hey, yeah, Bob Dylan. Way to go, Bob. That's great news for all musicians, you know.
Well, that's right. Rock's first Pulitzer is what they're saying about it. The committee cited Bob Dylan's, and I quote, profound impact on popular music and American culture marked by lyrical compositions of extraordinary poetic power.
Wow, yeah, they took the words right out of my mouth with that.
Yeah, well, you probably say that to Bob every time you see him.
I love Bob Dylan. Yeah. You know what I admire most?
What's that?
He's still working. He's 66, man, for crying out loud.
Well,
he's 66.
So what? Tony Bennett, you're 81.
Well, right. Yeah, it's right. But I'm a jazz singer, you know. Yeah. I don't have to play a guitar.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of wear and tear on the fingers and hands, I hear.
Yeah.
And your shoulder socket when you do that for years and years and years, like Bob's been doing.
Uh-huh.
He's been wearing tight jeans for decades.
Yeah.
That can hurt.
Yeah.
That can shorten your life, man.
Yeah.
And he's been putting that harmonica thing in his mouth over and over. I don't know if you've ever been on tour.
No, I haven't.
But things can get pretty unsanitary on the bus. And it's, you know, you get easy to get sick there.
So what you're saying is in the environment where Bob Dylan has been for so long, survival is a real achievement.
Yeah, believe me, every day you're alive, it's an accomplishment.
Well, maybe this special prize that he received will open the door for others to get the Pulitzer Prize, other long-lived, hard-working, iconic music personalities that we might have in mind.
Oui. Who are you talking about, Barry Manilow?
No, you, Tony.
Oh,
you.
No.
You're deserving, I think. You certainly are.
The Pulitzer is a writer's prize, man. Uh-huh. And I'm not a writer. I'm an interpreter of the Great American Songbook, but I'm not a writer like Bob.
Well, but still, it's a creative act when you interpret a song.
There's
artistry it's there.
It's with painting that I show my real creativity. Maybe if they invent a Pulitzer for painting.
Organizers did say, in fact, when they gave this prize to Bob Dylan, they're trying to broaden the scope of the Pulitzer so you could be the first winner of the Pulitzer Painting and Popular Song Interpreter Prize.
Wow.
It's created just for you. They would do that, I'll bet.
I feel very blessed that I've won all the awards I have. No need to make a new one, though, for me. I wish there could be a Pulitzer for all my fans, though. They've made me what I am today. The Pulitzer Appreciation Prize to all of them.
The always generous with praise, Tony Bennett.
Thank you, and I'm happy for Bob, too.
Well, let's play a Dylan song here, then.
Okay, I love this one because, he goes electric.
You like that because incites people, some people.
I like to be plugged in once in a while. It's about a prized possession, just like his Pulitzer medal.
It's called Leopard Skin Pillbox
Hat. I love that one.
And that's our podcast. The Morning Show is broadcast Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. on 89.3 The Current in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Most of our show is also on Minnesota Public Radio's regional network. Thanks to Jim Ed Poole for the character voices, to Mike Pengra, our producer, and to Michael Wells of our new media department for placing us online. All of our Morning Show bits are written by yours truly, Dale Connolly. And here is the point where Bob Dylan would sing, if our show were important enough to merit a personal appearance by Mr. Bob Dylan. But that's simply not possible in this case. Too bad for all of us. Maybe next week. You never know. We'll see you then.
I grew up in the D.C. area where Mstislav Rostropovich was our local cellist. And every year, I would say he would obviously play many, many concerts as a cellist and conductor. But usually the Dvorak would be somewhere in that realm of programming. Because it in many ways, obviously it's great music and it's got a wonderful cello part. But I think why it stands apart is that it's a wonderful symphony. And it happens to have a wonderful solo cello part in this great symphony.
Tell me, as a kid growing up in the D.C. area, what of what you just played has Rostropovich's stamp on it, if anything?
Oh, well, I mean, this has been the problem for me, is that, when Rostropovich first recorded this in the 50s, it was a very, very different vehicle for him, very different piece for him in his life. He was in his 30s, as I am now. He was playing this piece, and he wasn't, in the world's view, in my view, looking back, the Rostropovich we know of today. And having this had kind of turned into his vehicle, I keep using this word, but where so identified with this piece, it was kind of Rostropovich playing the Dvorak Concerto after a while. Kind of like Jacqueline Dupre and the Elgar in a way.
Yeah. You get more of the artist as opposed to
the composer? He's lived it. It's kind of one of those things that you've lived in the skin of Dvorak for so long that the two worlds kind of blur and collide, and it's Rostropovich's living, breathing Dvorak's world. Mm-hmm. So, again, I heard this monumental approach in the 80s that he'd been doing for 30 years, tens and 20 times a year. I think he's recorded it 9, 10, 11 times alone, just recording. And they're all very different, and you can see how they evolve. And they're all very different from the Pablo Casals version or the Emmanuel Feuermann version from 25 years before that. So as a student and as a professional now and a person that who's coming up with their own interpretation, that was the most difficult, is to kind of try to strip out this dominant force of someone like Rostropovich, where there was no one like, is no one like Rostropovich, and kind of go back to basics and kind of start with the blueprints of my own and build my view from there versus kind of doing a recycled version of what Rostropovich does, which you cannot win if you do that. You sound like a bad version of Rostropovich. So over the past 10 years, I've tried to start over with the piece, with all of this massive treasure chest of information to use when I feel like it's appropriate, but not because someone else has done it.
What got stamped on you as you heard Rostropovich play, and how did you relearn it? Because I can't really know the difference until I hear the difference.
Well, Rostropovich, first of all, you have to realize it, as I'm looking out over the hall right now, he gave people their money's worth. He was larger than life. He was the one of the greatest personalities one could ever imagine, both politically, musically, and all of this. And as I look out over these concert halls, he played for the last row. Everything he did was to share with the masses. It wasn't about the subtlety necessarily that was in the parts. But you have to also realize that when this music was written, it wasn't written for the arena style that we have today, these grand concert halls. So one of the things that I'm just going to verbalize this first, and I can show you several examples. But his dynamic scheme, his tempo relationships were much grander for the excess of the hall and presentation than what was written on the page. And you know what? I'm probably going to end up in the same place, but I'll find that place in my own way versus not knowing how I got there. He would exaggerate the beginnings of things. In fact, I used to think that the opening, it says improvisando, okay? You know, it means improvised a little bit, and quasi-improvisando, actually. And this is how he would play it. Okay, but the rhythm is... So he pulled the first one out of proportion and then changed the rhythm in many ways on the second one too. Da 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 da, and then. And I thought that's the way it went, and I never realized that, you know, again, you have to then, how do you do what he wrote without sounding like you're in a straitjacket? So you go back to basics. Now, a little improvised, just a little more mellowed out instead of being so rigid. This is kind of how I play it. Where you don't quite know where you're going. You're announcing the theme. Maybe that sounds all the same to you, but it's kind of working out mentally why the rhythms work the way they work. And the other issue is that this rhythm has been stated so many times.
By the orchestra already.
That's right. So you can't morph it too far, but maybe you can. Because, you know, obviously you don't want to do the same thing twice. So by this point, the whole orchestra starts, boom, ba-da-dum, boom, ba-da-dum, boom, ba-dum, ba-dum, boom. That's how it starts. So that's the theme is started. So, you know, I'm arguing with myself here, obviously, but by the time the cello's announcement comes, maybe this is why he writes improvisando, because we got it. We get it already. Mm-hmm. So work with it.
You can be a little freer with
it. A little freer with it. So it's kind of like you have to understand why someone has come up with the approach they have, or yourself. You can't just blindly play, because that makes it very deep if you know and can explain, as we are talking, about why something has worked out the way it is. The first theme of the very, very opening, the slow theme, typical Rostropovich would be... What a glorious, glorious theme. It's in piano, though. his passion, his energy just exuded and made everyone start crying immediately. Now, the issue that you have to ask also is it's a 40-minute concerto. Should we be crying immediately? Then what's after that?
It's a question about pacing and drama.
Well,
isn't it?
A little bit. It's hard to pace and have drama at the same time. I try to make this arc in the three movements where it's supposed to be soft.
That's just a different piece of music altogether, isn't
altogether.
It?
Altogether. It's just and you know, again, under the situation, you feel very differently, of course.
You know, as you're playing here, I'm hearing something different in this cello than I don't think I've ever heard in a cello before. It's not just volume, but there's something else in there. It's like an extra bit of oomph in there. What's going on in this instrument?
Funny you mentioned that. You know, when I growing up, I always heard Rostropovich play on his Stradivarius, the Dupour Strad. He had an amazing sound, and all the great cellists have their own sounds, but I never thought that was my voice. I didn't know what was missing. I didn't know what that was. But I always heard a sound in my head that I didn't deem being a real, as far as a cello was concerned. And about 11 years ago, I walked into a violin shop, and they showed me this cello. And the moment I played it, I was speechless. Hmm. It was the sound that I'd always dreamed possible. And what I was listening for, and I now can tell you what it is, this cello was made in 1693.
By whom?
By Matteo Gofriller. Okay. Bach was 8 years old when this cello was born in Venice, Italy. And it was originally made as a church bass, probably.
A church bass,
meaning it's just a very large cello, because when Stradivarius came around, during the same time, he decided that the cello should be more like a tenor, and he cut the mold down and made a smaller shape to cellos in general.
So this instrument, this Gofriller, is actually larger than
absolutely
some of the other instruments
That's
we can
right.
hear and see.
Yes, and partly because a lot of these makers who made the bigger instruments, once Stradivarius came out on the scene and started dominating in the making of the tenor-sounding cellos, cut their cellos down, thinking that that was going to make them be in the same realm as the popularity of Stradivarius. And this is one of the surviving cellos that was not cut down. And the thing that makes this so spectacular is that it's so earthy, and it's got extra wood in the bottom. It's shaped like a pear. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah, and it just looks like it's about, I'm going to guess and say, 4 to 6 inches bigger. The box is that much bigger than another.
Yeah, it's kind of a visual mystery, because it's not that much bigger. The bottom bouts across the bottom are bigger, probably by a half inch.
Oh, really?
And across the middle is bigger by about a half inch.
Okay.
But the top is the same. Huh. And that extra wood across the bottom and the length by a little bit, in the end, probably does equal to what you just said in the amount of excess throughout the whole instrument. Yeah. But the resonance and the breadth of the sound, you can't match.
Can you give me an example?
Sure.
Especially the highs and the lows, because I think that's where it's really showing up.
It keeps giving
It sounds like a Russian bass almost.
It does. And you know what's unusual about this is this was the cello that was in the Budapest Quartet for 40 years. And I understand why. You know, this guy could have had any, Misha Schneider could have had any cello on earth. And he was traveling enough that he probably saw all the cellos on earth. But imagine being in a quartet playing, holding together the glue of the quartet with this cello.
That would do it, wouldn't it?
I think you would hold on for dear life, and the other people would be like, wow.
Well, you know, this instrument is probably very happy on this stage because as you sit here in the cello box right in the middle, you've got two other Gofriller instruments around you. You've got the concertmaster who plays a Gofriller violin.
Interesting.
Rare. And you've got the principal cellist who also plays.
Well, oddly enough, while we were playing in the rehearsal, I turned around to the principal cellist and I asked him what kind of cello it was because I recognized the world of sound.
Oh, really?
You and could. I was like, I know, hear. I know that, I know something's going on there. And I think you know, Gofriller was known for being very particular for cellos. Pablo Casals played a Gofriller his whole life. Janos Starker, Pierre Fournier, Anar Bylsma. They are like the cellist's cellos because. You don't want a pretty sound all the time. You want something that's real, that's it's just imperfect, yeah. And also can be perfect.
Thank you.